This is Beersmith Podcast number 239. It's early July 2021. Michael Fairbrother joins me this week to discuss varieties and honey and mead.
This is the Beersmith Home Brewing Show, where brewing great beer is our passion. If you want to take your brewing to the next level, visit beersmith.com, where you can download a trial version of our Beersmith software, subscribe to the newsletter, and get dozens of free articles on home brewing. And now, your host and the author of Home Brewing with Beersmith, Brad Smith.
This is Beersmith Podcast number 239, and it's early July 2021. Michael Fairbrother joins me this week to discuss the varieties of honey and mead making. Thank you to this week's sponsors, Craft Beer and Brewing Magazine. Every issue of Craft Beer and Brewing Magazine is packed with articles for homebrewers and beer lovers. They offer access to videos, brewing courses, exclusive articles, and the amazing Craft Beer and Brewing Magazine. Go to beerandbrewing.com to get your subscription today. Again, that's beerandbrewing.com. And also the Brew Commander, the new brewhouse controller from Blickman Engineering. It's available in electric and gas propane models. The patent-pending Brew Commander is a high-quality brewhouse controller that offers automated step mashing, boil timers, precision temperature control, and advanced settings. Command your brew day with a new Brew Commander. To order yours today, go to blickmanengineering.com. And finally, I'm happy to say the new web-based version of Beersmith is available now at beersmithrecipes.com. Beersmith for the Web lets you build, edit, and brew recipes from any browser, including your desktop, your tablet, or your phone. The new web version gives you access to tens of thousands of recipes, online recipe editing, advanced water tools, and much more from any device. You can try Beersmith Web for free for 30 days by setting up an account at beersmithrecipes.com. If you purchase a Gold, Platinum, or Pro license, you get both Beersmith Web and the desktop version of Beersmith for one low price. Existing Beersmith Gold or higher members also get the web version for free. Check out beersmithrecipes.com now to give Beersmith Web a try. And now let's jump into this week's episode. Today on the show, I welcome Michael Fairbrother back. Michael is founder and head mead maker at Moonlight Meadery. Moonlight Meadery has won medals in the Mazer Cup every year they've entered. And Michael, it's great to have you back on the show. How are you doing?
I'm doing great, Brad. Nice to see you again.
So I had you on last, I think, in 2019. What have you been working on since then? I think you're actually coming from your new farm, right?
Yes. So my wife and I bought a farmstead up in Center New Hampshire. It's just about 100 acres. And we've got our gift shop open already, our outdoor terrace. We're planning on building a wedding venue, event space, and we want to move the winery and establish our brewery up here as well. So we have our beer being contract brewed for us right now, but I'm looking forward to being able to make my own and or have it made on property.
So how does this fit in with your original meadery, which is located, I think you said, quite a bit farther south, right?
Yeah, it's about 40 minutes further away, or 40 miles. And we'll eventually shut that facility down and everything will be here, but it's going to be at least another year, a year and a half to make all that happen.
Mm-hmm. And what are you growing at the farm?
So we've got mostly hay right now. So about 150 round bales. They're huge per harvest, and they harvest them twice a year. We've got 18 apple trees, so just the start of an orchard. Got some high bush blueberries, some raspberry bushes, and truckloads of blackberry bushes around the property.
Awesome. And are you looking to grow a lot of the ingredients locally eventually?
Yeah, I hope to have about 4,000 apple trees down one of the pastures that we have. But we've got a lot of wildlife that lives on the property, from deer, turkey, bobcats, porcupines. It seems like it's never ending when you walk out there and you just see, you know, a deer come sprinting out of the woods with its fawn right beside it. And it's cool.
And your new location's open. I think you mentioned you had a website, or what's it called again? It's Over the Moon, yeah. I think. Yeah.
Over the Moon Farmstead. So we've got our three brands now. We got Moonlight Meadery, Hidden Moon Brewing, and Over the Moon Farmstead. So the farmstead will eventually be the house for everything else.
That's awesome. Well, looking forward to seeing it. Today you actually wanted to discuss honey, which of course is the main component in mead. However, honey itself has some rather interesting properties, doesn't it?
Yes, it does.
Can you tell us a little bit about honey itself?
So honey is the only food source that never goes bad. So it's just, it's created from bees. They harvest nectar out of the flower, and they more or less pass it back and forth into the honey sacs of the other bees to add enzymes and to concentrate that nectar into honey. Honey has got a very low residual water level to it, so it's really high in bricks, about 85 bricks or so per batch, and it can range from water white, which is really light color, to dark amber, to almost brown or jet black, depending on the flower source where the bees go to. So the higher the mineral content, usually the darker the honey content, and flavors can vary quite significantly from one type of flower to another. Wildflower honey is typically a blend. So the big honey producers or packing companies have an ideal that they're trying to set a standard for, which they blend the sources that they get to what they consider their ideal. So, you know, honey's not just honey. Yeah, it's kind of like saying you don't like bread and you've only had one commercial store brought bread and not some artisan bread. Honeys can differ significantly from hive to hive, from time of year. Everything makes a difference.
And I found it interesting, honey has antibacterial properties too, right?
Some, yeah. The Manuka honey out of New Zealand, and they've used honey medicinally for, so the antimicrobial properties is it basically wicks the water out of the cells to prevent them from, so that's why yeast can't really grow on raw honey or mold or anything else. It basically, it's so devoid of water content, it kills anything that should try to take up or out on top of it.
And I mean, how long can honey last?
Indefinite.
Well, many people are familiar. I think, like in the grocery store, mostly I see clover honey, which, as you mentioned, I think is really kind of a mix, right?
So you have to imagine how honey gets, how honey is sourced, more or less. So beekeepers are paid to pollinate crops. And what they want to do is get rid of the honey so the bees keep going out to forage and pollinate the flowers. And if you're a commercial honey producer, you want to move your hives around so that you can keep them producing as much honey as possible or getting paid to pollinate as many crops as possible. For example, there's over 2 million beehives that move to California to pollinate the almond crops that take place for that short period of time. And then once those blooms are gone, you know, your bees don't have anything else to forage on because of the way the farming is taking place. So they move them to another field and then they start the process all over again. So that's how you can get mono type flower sources, which is, you know, you got a large enough crop of particular flower, your bees aren't really going to go beyond the closest flower source they have to. So that gets you those types of flowers or that type of honey.
So can you contrast maybe clover honey with some of the other honeys that you might be able to use or find?
Sure. So, well, I'll go with the real hard. So orange blossom honey, really nice and light, really has a really distinctive flavor. It's not going to taste like oranges per se, but, an orange honey is a, conglomerate of citrus style honey. So it could be lemons, grapefruits, or oranges. But those type of crops define what becomes orange blossom honey. Clover honey, a lot more neutral, little more, you know, middle of the road type of flavor profile. Then you could go to something like a dark star thistle or a buckwheat honey. Buckwheat honey is really dark, almost molasses-like color to it. And, you know, I find that honey pretty objectionable flavor wise once it's fermented through. but I have had some examples made by some fellow mead makers that I have enjoyed, but it's still got a pretty pronounced flavor. Heather honey from Scotland's got a really earthy note to it. In general, I like the lighter, you know, the lighter colored honeys to start with when they ferment. And one of the things that I did as a home mead maker was to play around with, you know, 1 pound of honey, so 16 ounces of honey, and, you know, make a half gallon growler of mead with it. So take 64 ounces or less than 16, so whatever, 48 ounces of water and 16 ounces of honey, and make a batch and try them all, see what the flavors taste like. Because it's a lot easier to spend your money on a pound of honey than to buy, you know, 60 pounds worth and try to figure out if you really like something or not.
And the differentiation between the different kinds of honey is really driven by the what they're feeding off of, right?
Yeah, exactly. So each flower has a different type of nectar to it, and that really changes everything there is to think about the honey. I mean, it's kind of like the difference between rye bread and pumpernickel or wheat, and, you know, it's just they're all bread, but, you know, the flavor there is just, and the aroma from the bread is so much different. And the same is true if you think about beer styles, for example, like a Pilsner to a stout. You know, they're all made with malt, but different types of malt. And it's how they roast or take care of those malts that really change the flavor. Now, you can do things to honey to make the flavor change even more, whether you want to cook it or boil it to make like a bochet. But just if to play with straight up traditional meads, you know, your honey is providing the terroir of the flavor.
And one of the interesting things I found is you were mentioning that beekeepers are primarily, you know, family-owned businesses here in the United States, right?
That's my understanding. There are some big honey packing companies, and they source their honey in bulk. I mean, we buy ballpark about 40,000 pounds of honey per year, and we buy them in 3,200-pound totes, so it's... And we just had our first tote damaged in delivery. So I can't even imagine what a 3,200-pound truck or box of honey looks like leaked all over the back of a truck. But that's a big cleanup.
Yeah, that is a big cleanup. But but most of the beekeepers are actually family-owned, and then they source the larger distributors, right?
Yes.
That's interesting. Kind of an interesting business. And as you mentioned, a lot of them move their bees every month. I don't know.
Yeah. You got to really keep on track. The National Honey Board has put together a little map that kind of shows the pollination map around the country of where they're moving hives and, you know, what flowers are in bloom. And, you know, I use honeylocator.com, which is also sponsored by the National Honey Board to list what kind of honey flowers and sources are available time of year. Some honeys are really hard to come by. Meadow foam is pretty expensive. Tupelo honey, really expensive. And it's just got to do with, you know, so the way the temperature has changed, it's changed some of the blooming patterns of the flowers. So now the tupelo trees are blooming very similar to the almond crop, and a lot of the hives are being moved from one crop to another, based on who pays. And nobody's usually paying somebody to harvest tupelo honey because of it's not a cash crop. Nobody's trying to get those trees pollinated. The bees love them, but you know, it's just a little bit
hard to find.
Yeah, or when you find it, you're paying through the nose. Yeah, you know, I get it commercially at almost three times the price of what I pay for you know, like an orange blossom honey.
Where do you source less common forms of honey?
Well, that's like I was saying, honeylocator.com is a great tool to find honey by the flower type, honey by the state, or, you know, your local suppliers. You want to be cognizant that you might think you're dealing with a local honey supplier, but they may have bought in bulk, and they're just selling you the honey that they're pulling out of a drum. You know, it's I really want to, you know, when I'm dealing with my local beekeepers, I want to know they have the hives, where they have the hives, you know, what time of year are they harvesting, what's going on with the in the field sources that where those honeys or bees are pollinating, because all that makes a difference. You know, you certainly, you know, I certainly want to keep any kind of pesticides away from our finished product, and that's why we source organic honey for the most part. So it's really doesn't have any kind of opportunity to have any kind of possible contamination.
And I mean, how do you make sure it's fresh and high quality?
Well, that's almost impossible. So unless you're actually there when they're harvesting the honey and you're watching it be decapped and put into your container, you have to take somebody's word for it. So, because if honey crystallizes, you can always heat it up to reconstitute it back. And, you know, ideally, you want a freshest honey as possible. You know, we do heat our honey up before we process to bottle or make our mead, and we'll heat it up to about 80 degrees Fahrenheit, which is more or less beehive temperature. So we want to, we don't want to denature the enzymes, and we want to, you know, keep that honey full of as much natural goodness as it has, so that, you know, we can't legally tell people that honey's good for you or mead's good for you, but, you know, we're trying to stay as fresh and clean of flavor as possible. And that's, I mean, it's really paid off for us in the long run. I mean, from the competitions we enter and win, you know, it's something that has to be consistent, and that's part of it.
Well, side question, but I have some older bottles of honey that have hardened. How do you deal with that?
So I'd recommend a warm water bath. So if you're heat your water up to, let's say, 120 degrees and you know, you leave your water or your honey jars in there, that'll eventually soften them up. And they will turn back towards liquid state. Like I said, around 80 degrees it will be its temperature.
What causes that? I mean, why does it crystallize?
It's natural. There's only one type of honey that doesn't crystallize, to my knowledge, and that is Tupelo honey. Every other honey should naturally crystallize. Honey will not crystallize like in the grocery stores because it's been ultra filtered and heavily processed. So the grocery stores think of honey crystallization as a fault. It's actually a sign that it's real honey. And, you know, it's got everything it's supposed to have in it.
I mean, is that one of the reasons you heat yours a little bit before you work with it or not?
Yeah. So we want to be able to move it. So yeah. We have a honey pump, and that pump can pull the honey out of a tote through a 2-inch thick hose. And it's a lot easier when it's a little warmer than if it's at, you know, room temperature or it really has to do with time of processing and the like.
You mentioned playing with different kinds of honey by making mini batches. Can you walk us through what it would take to just, you know, make a simple mini batch and, you know, the nutrients and other things that you might add?
Sure. So we use pretty common standard staggered nutrient addition regime. So if you go to the meadmaderight.com website, Sergio from Melovino has put together a really nice calculator for people that you can put your starting gravity, your batch size, and it'll tell you, you know, your four additions of nutrients, how much Fermade O or GoFerm or Fermade K that you might need to use. So for us, we're always rehydrating our yeast first, and we use GoFerm to do that. And I forget what the size ratio is for small batches, but it's not a very lot, like a teaspoon or two. And it's a warm water to rehydrate, roughly about, I think, 110 degrees.
Yeah, so I do the same thing. I think I have a couple articles on it. Beersmith does the calculations too. You were mentioning.
Yeah. So, you know, all that, you know, obviously Beersmith does this. I should pay more attention. But, you know, once I'll squirt a little bit of honey into the rehydration, just to make sure they proof the yeast that it's actually active before, we pitch it. And you want to attemperate your must, and your yeast so that there's not going to be a temperature shock. And then once you've gotten your first, your yeast in there, and 24 hours has gone by, then you start your first edition, then 48 hours and 72 hours. And then it's essentially more or less like a week later, you should be at about a third of the sugar has dropped, you know, started to ferment at this point in time. But you should see very active fermentation very soon once you've added your yeast to the must and everything is going along right. I would typically say most home brewers don't pitch enough yeast. We're pitching about a gram per gallon. So, you know, so a 5 gallon batch needs 5 grams. I don't believe dry yeast is sold in that kind of quantity. So it might be, you know, a tenth of that much, but it's certainly possible to use less yeast and grow it up over time beforehand. It's just the real key towards a successful fermentation is, you know, keeping your yeast happy, keeping it at a temperature it likes to work at. I recommend 71B. It's the yeast that I've been using commercially now for a little over 12 years. And it and I get along well. Yeah. So
I was going to say, is that still the yeast you use exclusively or not?
Yeah, pretty much.
Wow.
And I use it for my cider too. So it's just, you know, I do vary significantly for the beers that we make. I don't use that yeast for any of the beer we're brewing, even though the beer has honey in it. I stick to more traditional beer recipe style brands for any of the braggots that we make.
Right. Yeah. And I think we did an episode on braggots some time ago, but I mean, you're making braggot with the honey right in the mix, right?
Yeah. So we add the honey at knockout. So it's the boil has finished. We're all set. All the hops have been added and we're at whirlpool time and trying to drop the temperature. And that's where we'll infuse the honey because we're trying, again, not to cook that honey and denature those flavors.
And for these mini batches, I think you were saying you start with a pound of honey and then you said half gallon batches, something like that, right?
Yeah, so I use half gallon growlers. So I had, I don't know, dozens of these things forever. And so my basement looked like, you know, a collector's closet of growlers. So I said, well, yeah, I was collecting honey and I'm looking at all these growlers. I'm like, oh, that's a perfect ratio. One part honey, three parts water. And that's pretty much the ratio that we still use today, even for the big batches that we make. And you can go a little more water and you'll get drier. And you can go a little less water and you'll get sweeter. But at 1 to 3, it's you know, it's a semi-sweet towards sweet, depending on how the yeast finishes.
Hmm. So, I mean, that's not your giant, you know, big fruit bead where you're actually trying to push the gravity way up, right?
Right. No, yeah. My fruit meads are sometimes monsters where, yeah, you know, the gravity might be 40 bricks, which is 40% sugar.
So, if I'm going to make a bunch of mini batches, what varieties do you recommend starting with? What are some of your favorites that you use?
Yeah. So, Almond Blossom is a nice dark one. I've done Butter Bean. I've done Star Thistle. I've done Avocado Blossom. Arizona Pecan Blossom is dark, but delicious.
What's avocado taste like?
It's dark. It's a nutty, type of flavor to it. Hmm. And, it's funny cause you know, we got two that we import the honey from Africa, one from Tanzania, one from Zimbabwe. And the one is, you know, dark, dark brown, really mocha coffee notes to it, earthy. And then the other one's like a light gold. And, you know, the people that like dark honey love these darker meads. Hmm. Yeah. I find it a little harder, a little more of a clash on the palate than I want. I try to find the lighter the honey is more delicate, and then I can work better with trying to figure out how do I want to capture the essence of that honey. And around 14% ABV, you know, you have room to balance all the pieces out.
How do you, let's say you're going to design a new mead from scratch, how do you go about starting that process with a blank sheet of paper?
Well, for traditional mead, it's pretty straight up. You pick a different type of honey and you rock and roll with it. If I'm trying to make a Melomel or a Metheglin, you know, my Metheglins always start from a really good base traditional. So usually an orange blossom is my go-to for making Metheglins. And what I'll do then is figure out what kind of spicing do I want to achieve and how do I want those spices to present, whether it be with peppers or vanilla or cinnamon or ginger. It's all a nuance. And then I try to think of, well, if I like this combination, how would I like that in contrast to this? So I'm always kind of tinkering, and a lot of it's done in my head, right? So a mm-hmm. lot of it is just me thinking about the flavors and thinking about, well, will this work? Like, we have one called Monkey Bread, which is a banana cinnamon maple mead, and people swear they could taste like nuts and stuff in it, but it's just the way the maple and the cinnamon tie in with the banana notes. And you know, we went with a lot of bananas. So we pureed the bananas up, and then we got some, you know, top grade, you know, maple syrup here in New Hampshire and Madagascar bourbon, not vanilla beans, Vietnamese cinnamon in that one. And it's good. Just trying to look at some of my flavors. I've got my bar lineup on the other side here. So we did a cherry chipotle one. So once I play with
cherry chipotle.
Yeah, it's good. The spice really is more of a tingle on the back of the throat, so the cherries really come through. But like, we've started our decadence series, so we have a strawberry one, a boysenberry, a cherry, and I'm missing one. It don't matter. Raspberry.
How'd the boysenberry come out? It seems like that would be a great match.
Yeah, the chocolate is really, really depth. So we're using about a pound of roasted cacao nibs per gallon. So at that volume, you know, it's chocolate. It's chocolate, right. chocolate.
Right.
And you get it in the aroma and the flavor. And then I was trying to figure out, well, what do I do with all those roasted cacao nibs when I'm done? Because I was throwing them all away. And I found that you could toast them and then put them through a melanger, which is a grinder, and make chocolate. So we've been playing around with making chocolate. I've got chocolate molds now. I've got a proofing to bring the temperature up. So I've been trying to teach myself how to become a chocolatier. The melanger takes about 24 to 48 hours to get it smooth. The longer you can let it run, the smoother that chocolate tastes and presents on your palate.
To grind it all up, huh?
It takes forever. Mm. Like, the guy was like, it looks ground. Taste it. I'm like, chewing sandpaper. I'm like, okay.
Well, let's talk about sweetness levels in mead, which is one of the big differentiators between mead styles. What are the major levels of sweetness and how do they sort of play into the overall mead?
Yeah, so you got dry, semi, well, there's now, I think, five levels. A few years back, it was three. So dry, semi, and sweet. Now you have like off dry and I think semi dry. It's really small nuances that really change the overall perception. I've met an awful lot of commercial and amateur mead makers that talk about the dryness, and a really dry mead doesn't really work all that well because people expect honey to have a little bit of sweetness to it. That's not saying it's not possible. It's just, it's a harder challenge to overcome. But essentially you've got the actual sweetness of the must or the mead when it's finished and what people perceive the sweetness to be. And there's three things that I've been able to determine that control those. One is the actual sweetness level. Two is the residual pH of that mead, and three would be the alcohol level and how hot or how spicy that alcohol note is. So if you can ferment at a really controlled temperature where you're not getting the higher fusel alcohols, you get this, it's easier to work with, right? So, you know, if you're making a dry mead, you need everything to be at perfect. So there you're playing with your acidity level to get it to present the way you want it to present versus to have it seem off-putting. Yeah. So you always want to keep the idea of honey flavor and how you want that to work. But you want to make it, you know, I'm not trying to make anything I make taste like a wine, but you're trying to keep it in balance. So if you think about, you know, what makes wines work, it's a balance, right? So it's that totality of the beverage. One of the ways I describe it to people at conferences and stuff, it's to think about, you know, when you eat a sausage, you're not worried about what goes into the sausage per se, or you don't necessarily need to know what goes into the sausage. You're trying to think about how well is that flavor integrated into the overall meal that's being presented. And with a really good mead, that's the kind of the same thing. You just because the raw ingredients were honey, water and yeast, or honey and chili peppers and something else, you know, it doesn't mean you want to taste every little piece of it. You know, if you say you've got five fruits in a particular mead, you know, and judges are dinging you because they can't find the cherries, even though you put cherries into it, you know, maybe it's not a mead for that judge, right? And so, yeah. You know, I've seen, you know, you can... It depends on what you're trying to accomplish, right? So if you want to win competitions, then you want to think about what can judges perceive and what are they taste and how they're going to taste it. And, you know, the best judges I've met, I'll look at, you know, again, that kind of that totality of what's here. How is it filled? You know, what's the clarity? What's the sweetness level? And, you know, how does that alcohol all pull it together? Because you can... Yeah, you can work some things in your favor, like timing, like how long do you want to age a particular mead. You know, we've released a commercial release of our Utopian X, which is 10 years in a Sam Adams Utopius barrel. And they actually prefer Samuel Adams, not Sam Adams. So Samuel Adams Utopius barrel. And it's, you know, it's kind of like its own thing. You know, we've released 1,000 bottles and we only have, I think, 400 or so left at this point. But, you know, I'm charging a premium for it because it spent 10 years sitting in the warehouse in a barrel that I kept my hands off of for 10 years. And I certainly want to enjoy it myself. But
yeah, I have a Barolo wine that's aging, and that's an exercise in patience. I think it's like a minimum of 5 years. So,
wow.
Let's walk through those three things that you mentioned earlier, though. Residual sweetness. So first, how do you get residual sweetness into a mead? Because obviously, if you just throw yeast in there and water, it's going to ferment pretty dry, right?
Yeah. Well, the yeast has a tolerance level. So how much will it ferment? So if your yeast is going to ferment at about 14%, you know, you need to at least be 28 bricks as a starting point. And I'm sorry, I talk bricks versus starting gravities anymore, but
if I remember right, the 71B you're using is like 100 points of gravity. So if you think about 100 points of OG, I guess.
Right. So your 50% of your points go to CO2 production, 50 go to alcohol production. So when you're talking about 28 bricks, you got about 14% potential alcohol content. Mm-hmm. So if you want to bump up your residual sugar, you set that sweetness level at the start to say 32, and then you're going to have about 4% residual sweetness, and that could be really sweet depending on your finishing bricks or not.
So talking, by the way, we're talking really high starting gravities here, like 1150, 1160 kind of thing, right?
Yeah, 1160 would be about 40 bricks, so that's 40% sugar. So the
way
bricks,
up there.
Yeah, so it's when your hydrometer should have like a triple scale on them. Refractometers often usually measure in bricks, I think.
I think you can multiply by 4 too to get the bricks to gravity roughly.
That's correct. Yeah. So, you know, the other option you have for residual sweetness is blending your meads after fermentation. You need to be careful to make sure you don't restart fermentation when you do that. And definitely be careful if you're doing that in sealed bottles, because you might create bottle bombs that'll explode and throw glass all over the place. I did one of the last Mead for Your Die competitions. I had some entries come in, and I put a bottle down and glass went 10 feet around me. So you got to be really careful. Definitely recommend corks if you've got any kind of suspicion that you're not quite as good as you think you are. You know, because corks aren't going to kill somebody or take out an eye. Well, I guess it could, but way less likely to hurt yourself with a cork bottle than you are with a sealed up container.
So that's how you get the residual sweetness up, right? Of course, you can back sweeten too. I think we didn't talk about that, but
sure. Yeah, I usually back sweeten through blending. So I'll make a sweet mead that's stabilized, and then I'll blend it with a drier mead to get some of that residual sweetness there. Don't often have to do that, but sometimes, you know, either, you know, mechanically wise, temperature control fails and the batch ferments a little drier than we'd like, or, you know, or it just happens that way. But, you know, even after the millions of bottles we've made and sold, you know, it's still a natural process. There's still art that has to happen. You know, it's not just mechanical, like do this, and it's all good to go.
Right. So as you drive the residual sweetness level up, you're also, of course, now start to have to worry about things like structure, because if you have too much sweetness, it's awful, really.
Right.
And so that brings to the second point, which you talked about, which is pH.
Yeah. So there are ways to modify your finishing pH, whether it's citric acid or using things like lemon juice or lime juice to modify or bring down that pH to be nice and clean on the palate. Doesn't take a lot. You definitely need a really good pH meter to be able to control and measure. But if anybody wants to do stabilization, you need that pH meter anyway, because you've got to your sulfites and your pH level are hand in hand. So if you have a pH that's near 4, you can almost guarantee you can't stabilize it, because the pH and the effectiveness of the pH with the sulfites really goes towards hand in hand. So like we usually try for,
That's okay.
Got a fly flying around me. I thought I was going to get him. we tend to shoot for like 3.2, 3.0. You know, and pH is logarithmic, so, you know, you got to be careful with your pHs and your adjustments. I tend to go light on adjusting because it's not my strong suit. You know, my stronger suit is knowing the tartness of fruits and working from there.
Well, that's another point, too. I mean, one of the ways you control your pH, I know in your larger meads, is you add acidic fruits, right?
Right, like blackcurrant has got very acidic, tart, and tart cherries, same thing. So blueberries and the like, raspberries a little tart, depending how fresh you get them and how early in the season. You know, the peaches, for example, not quite as, you know, rich, a lot more tartness to it.
But those provide the structure so that you can then drive the sweetness level up if you want. Like if you're making a black currant mead, I assume you're using a fairly high gravity, right?
Yeah, my Embrace, for example, has just got a really nice depth of character to it from the tartness of the currants. And even though it presents fairly sweet, I mean, actually presents really dry, it's actually got a fair amount of sweetness to it, because that's what's balancing the whole thing and holding it all together. Mm-hmm. And it presents almost like a nice big red, big bold Cabernet.
And then the last point is alcohol, right? So the alcohol level also plays a significant role, right?
Right. So that's why I really enjoy doing the 14%ers, because it has that, you know, to me, it's my canvas to which I create all my flavors on.
I have a preference for the high gravity fruit meads, as you know, but what styles of mead and sweetness levels are really most popular with the consumers right now?
Customers like them sweet. So we have a lot of customers that say they don't like sweet stuff, but they come in and they try like our bourbon barrel Kurt's apple pie and they buy it. You know, it's just,
yep.
People like familiar things. The newest batch of red dress that we make, red currant, not as tart as a black currant. That's really been flying off the shelf. So it's in, you know, price wise, you know, that doesn't seem to be a determination factor for customers. They, you know, with the pandemic, we couldn't let a lot of people try what we were making. So that was pretty rough. But now that we can, you know, it's, It's really been going great. Hmm.
And of course, I think most of the ones you do sell are sweet fruit meads, right? Primarily?
Yeah.
I say the most popular, I should say, right?
Yes, that's absolutely correct. Yeah. Kurt's Apple Pie, Desire, all through the charts, sweet and delicious.
Yeah. Well, I wanted to get your closing thoughts on picking the right honey for your mead.
Start with orange blossom and go from there. I would go careful with the darker honeys, use more of a spice. So if you want to use a buckwheat, use maybe 10% in a batch to kind of gauge where you like to go, or make a buckwheat mead, make a traditional, two traditional meads and blend and figure out what, where those flavors are and what do you like and what don't you like.
And for folks that haven't had good mead, you're distributed nationwide now, I think, or virtually nationwide now. And so I wanted to give you a chance to mention Moonlight Meadery, where you can find the stuff, and also your new farm.
Yeah, so Over the Moon Farmstead is our remote tasting room and gift shop. Moonlightmeadery.com is where you can buy our meads and have them shipped to you, almost in 38 states now. So a lot of great flavors and potential there, but good stuff.
And if you haven't had good mead, I do encourage you to try some of Michael's meads. They are fantastic. And Michael, thank you again for coming on the show today. Really appreciate you taking out time out of your busy schedule.
Okay. Sounds great, Brad. Thank you.
And my guest today was Michael Fairbrother, award-winning mead maker and founder at Moonlight Meadery. Thanks again, Michael. Appreciate it.
Take care.
A big thank you to Michael Fairbrother for joining me this week. Thanks also to Craft Beer and Brewing Magazine. They offer access to videos, brewing courses, exclusive articles, and the amazing Craft Beer and Brewing Magazine. Go to beerandbrewing.com to get your subscription today. And also the Brew Commander, the new brewhouse controller from Blickman Engineering. It's available in electric and gas propane models. The patent-pending Brew Commander is a high-quality brewhouse controller that offers automated step mashing, boil timers, precision temperature control, and advanced settings. Command your brew day with a new Brew Commander. To order yours today, visit BlickmanEngineering.com. Again, that's BlickmanEngineering.com. And I'm happy to say the new web-based version of Beersmith is available now at BeersmithRecipes.com. Beersmith for the web lets you build, edit, and brew recipes from any browser, including your desktop, tablet, or phone. You can try Beersmith Web for free for 30 days by setting up an account at BeersmithRecipes.com. If you purchase a Gold, Platinum, or Pro license, you get both Beersmith Web and the desktop version for one low price. Existing Beersmith Gold or higher members also get the web version for free. Check out BeersmithRecipes.com today to give it a try. I'd like to thank you for listening, and I hope you have a great brewing week.